So, Ed Glaser, recent research indicates that humans, or at least something close to humans, have been living on this planet for perhaps 6 million years. In your view, what is our greatest invention?
I think the city is our greatest invention because it plays to something that is so fundamental in humanity. It plays to our ability to learn from one another, and that ability has evolved over 6 million years, and it's made us what we are.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Ed Glaser is a Harvard economist whose research covers everything from obesity and crime to innovation and urban policy. He's also the author of a book called Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. And you're thinking, the city? Our greatest human invention? Healthier? Greener? Glaser, are you for real? Yeah, he's for real. Let's start with why blacktop is actually greener than grass.
On a pleasant spring day in 1844, a young Harvard graduate and a friend went out for a picnic in the woods outside of Concord. They did a little bit of fishing, and the fishing was good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And they decided to cook a chowder using the fish. Now, there was a little bit of wind, and the flames flicked from their fire to the nearby tall grass. A fiery inferno ensued, and by the time it was done, more than 300 acres of prime Concord woodland had been burned to the ground. That young Harvard graduate was, of course, Henry David Thoreau, the modern patron secular saint of environmentalism. And it's hard to imagine that there was any Bostonian, merchant, even industrialist during his time period, who did as much damage to the environment as Henry David Thoreau did. Now, there's a lesson there, which is we're a destructive species. It's one of our defining characteristics, right? We make a big mess when we're around stuff. And if you love nature, stay away from it. Right? We're much more likely to harm nature, as Thoreau did when we lived surrounded by the woods, than if we live in tall urban apartments by ourselves. Now, there's a statistical partner to that, which is together with Matthew Kahn, I've assembled data on carbon emissions associated with living in different parts of the country. And there are two facts which I think are important to come out of that. One of which is that people who live in cities do tend to emit significantly less carbon than people who live in countries. And this is a controlling for incoming, controlling for family size. That's coming mainly from driving, from the fact that there's just a lot fewer carbon emissions associated with dense living. It's not just the move to public transportation. It's also for drivers within cities. They're just driving much shorter distances. And then, of course, it's because of smaller homes. The higher price of urban space means that people are living in smaller homes, even with the same family size. And that leads to lower electricity usage, lower home heating usage. And those are the facts that I think make cities seem, at least to my eyes, significantly greener. I think this is really important when we think about the future of countries like China and India. The future carbon emissions of the world are going to be a lot lower if China's urban patterns and if India's urban patterns look like New York, look like dense cities, than if they look like American suburban sprawl. And that's why, in fact, I think it's particularly important that the sort of great carbon-related battles of the 21st century, I think, will have a lot to do with urban development patterns in Asia. One second point, though, that comes out of the patterns across areas within the U.S. is that there are big differences across metropolitan areas in terms of carbon emissions, where the Sun Belt tends to be, the old Sun Belt tends to be the highest emissions places like Houston and Oklahoma City, mostly because they're just very, very hot and they have huge electricity usage. Their electricity usage isn't all that, production isn't all that green either. And the lowest by far is in coastal California, where they just have this temperate climate. Now, you'd think then that if you were interested in reducing America's entire carbon footprint, that people in California would be championing new development in high-rises around San Francisco Bay. These areas are by far the lowest carbon-related areas in the country, and if you built lots of high-rises in these attractive areas where there's plenty of demand, you would significantly reduce our overall carbon footprint. Yet, unfortunately, there's been a mistake that people have looked at their local situation and thought that by stopping a building, they were making things greener. But that's not really how things work, because if I turn off the spigot of housing in coastal California, it turns on somewhere else. It turns on in the desert outside of Phoenix. It turns on in Houston. And the place where the new building is going on is almost surely going to be more carbon intensive than coastal California. So implicitly, by pushing development away from California, many environmentalists have actually increased carbon emissions for the country as a whole.
Now, Ed, you grew up in Manhattan, correct?
Indeed.
Your father was born in Berlin, I read. You, I know, got your PhD in economics from Chicago, the University of Chicago. Now you teach at Harvard, so you live near Boston. So you're pretty much a lifelong city dweller. Persuade me that your conclusions about the greatness of the city are not a result of personal bias, whether subconscious or otherwise.
Well, I don't know if I can do that. But it is true that when I started acquiring small children, my wife and I did move out to a fairly sylvan suburb. So I certainly have had the experience of living in suburbs, which has pluses and negatives. I mean, it's really – suburban life is really, at least as I experience, is, of course, half urban, right? So I go to work in a city. We go to Boston for museums and restaurants and all sorts of things that I drag my kids to despite their protests. Unquestionably, we actually have the experience of living in a suburb. And certainly, you know, nothing in the book suggests that people who choose suburban life are necessarily making a mistake by doing that. What I'm arguing against is policies like artificially subsidizing home ownership, like artificially subsidizing highways, and like our very difficult problem of local schooling that are pushing people into suburbs. I mean, I'm just arguing that people should be free to choose without government policies that follow Jefferson's lead and, you know, vastly bias the decision against urban life.
Talk to me about some of the feedback. I was interested to see on the blog yesterday, a lot of the commenting was along the lines of, oh, this is a Harvard professor who's in an ivory tower. Of course he likes cities. He's in the upper class. He travels well when he goes to cities. And the fact of the matter is that he's got it all wrong. The cities are horrible, big, noisy places. And the place where I live is optimal. So it seems like people generally have a very strong identification, if not a bias, with the choices that they've made about where they live. Talk to me about the feedback along those lines to your book.
Well, it's certainly right that different people like different types of living, right? So it's a great thing that we have suburbs that enable people to live in their own areas. I differentiate myself from the great urbanist Jane Jacobs, who had wonderful ideas of cities, many of which, you know, show up in the book and have changed my views of this. But Jacobs seemed to have a very particular view of what urban life was supposed to be like. She believed in the Greenwich Village neighborhood in which she lived, and that led her to champion, you know, strong limits on building up, strong preservation of older areas, and a particular vision of urban life that was her vision, that was her area. That's very different from the economist's perspective, right? What I'm championing is unleashing cities. What I'm championing is rethinking those barriers to building that would enable places where the market demand is there, when there are people who actually want to live in high-rise apartments. I'm championing eliminating the barriers that stop that from happening. I'm not championing anyone who loves his quiet rural area and saying that, gosh, we want to shoehorn this person into an apartment. Obviously, some people don't want that, and that's terrific. It's wonderful the market can deliver lots of different living styles. I will say that, you know, it's pretty easy to see in the data that there are real advantages from urban areas, and that's certainly one of the things that I try to make clear in the book. And it is certainly true that one of the things that I try to fight against is the historic misconception, the prejudice that cities are somehow or other decaying and corrupt. That, I believe, is completely wrong. But I'm not arguing that everyone should live in a city.
Okay, so let's say you're interested in Glaser's notion of unleashing cities. What are the barriers to doing that?
I think that at the federal level, there are three issues, one of which is the home mortgage interest deduction. The home mortgage interest deduction essentially acts as a push away from urban apartments into suburban homes. There's a good reason for this. If you rent out single-family detached housing, they they depreciate on average more than 1% a year, according to some studies. And that's quite easy to understand. Renters don't do the maintenance that homeowners do taking care of their homes. On the other hand, anyone who's ever dealt with a co-op board knows that having a ton of owners under a single roof can be like herding cats. So there are good reasons why that's actually why larger buildings are sensibly rented. Well, if high-density dwellings are typically rented and low-density dwellings are typically owned, then if you're going to have a huge public push where hundreds of billions of dollars are going to be thrown to promote home ownership, you're basically telling cities to go drop dead, right? You're basically pushing people out of urban apartments into suburban homes. And I think that's a mistake. We've been huge on building infrastructure in this country for a long time. And some of those investments, like the Erie Canal, proved to have very high returns.
Especially, I mean, the Erie Canal especially had high returns for New York, from what I understand, right? I mean, it really helped turn New York into the market town that it became.
It was very, very helpful. Although it is true that the growth of New York was just as fast before the canal as after the canal. But sure, the canal was clearly important. And it also didn't actually end up requiring much subsidy, right? I mean, it actually generated huge returns, direct returns on the ground, which is usually true of the best forms of infrastructure investment, right? Really good infrastructure can actually pay for itself with user fees. But I worry about a renewed push towards building more transportation infrastructure in this country. The work of Nathaniel Bam Snow finds that every new highway that cut into a major city in the post-war period reduced that city's population by 18% because of suburbanization. You know, we're transportation is sort of the opposite of urban clustering. You're sort of subsidizing people to spread out. And the third thing, which is not really a federal issue, but it's huge, is our local system of schooling. Right. Certainly for anyone who's a parent like myself, the suburban school districts offer a huge enticement to leave cities. And this is really a question of how we've decided to structure our schools. So I want you to just imagine if, for example, instead of having a New York restaurant scene that was dominated by private entrepreneurs who competed wildly with each other, trying to come up with new things, and you know, the bad restaurants collapse, the good restaurants go on to cooking show fame, and you know, you have these powerful forces of competition and innovation working. Imagine instead if there was a food superintendent who operated a system of canteens where the menus were decided at the local level, and every New Yorker had to eat in these canteens. Well, the food would be awful. And that's kind of what we decided to do with schooling, that instead of harnessing the urban ability to, you know, provide innovation, competition, new entry, we've put together a system where we've turned all that stuff off and we've allowed only a huge advantage for a local public monopoly. It's very, very difficult to fix this. I think the most hopeful signs, and there's been, a steady stream of economics papers on this, the most hopeful signs, I think, are coming from charter schools, which are particularly effective in urban areas. And it's not so much that the average charter school is so much better than the average public school, but rather that in charter schools, because they can go bankrupt, because they can fail, the good ones will succeed and the bad ones will drop out of the market. And certainly we've seen lots of great randomized studies that have shown the ability of charters to deliver great test score results. So I think reform on schooling is really absolutely central. And I think in the case of cities, it really means harnessing the urban ability to generate competition and new startups.
Excellent. I see it's your time. I'll just ask you for a one-word answer. Ed Glaser, what is your favorite city in the world?
I can't possibly pick favorites. It's like picking favorites among children. But
Top three. How many children do you have?
I have three.
All right. So give me your three favorite cities then.
Boston, New York, Chicago, in the U.S. Worldwide. Barcelona, Hong Kong, London.
Very good. Ed, I thank you so much. It was really a treat to speak with you.
Oh, great to speak to you as well. Thank you so much.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we talk to the mayor of a city that's not in Glaser's top three.
El pueblo de Nuestra Señora, la Reina de Los Ángeles de Porciúncula, which has luckily been shortened to Los Angeles.
And please take advantage of our free weekly Freakonomics Radio podcast, which you can find at Freakonomics.com, on Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast delivery system. Thanks.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today, we are speaking with the mayor of
El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora, La Reina de Los Ángeles de Porciúncula, which has luckily been shortened to Los Angeles.
That's right.
I'm Eric Garcetti. I'm the mayor of the city of Los Angeles.
Garcetti is taking action to help immigrants on the verge of being deported. KCAL 9's Andrew.
Under Mayor Garcetti's leadership, LA has embraced technology to agree never before.
Some suspect he would like to run for governor or the U.S. Senate in 2018.
Tell me something I don't know about Los Angeles. So everyone in the world is at least a little familiar with L.A., or at least an image of L.A., but tell me something that only a true insider or a real long-timer would know.
Los Angeles was founded before Washington, D.C. People think we're a new city, but when the Continental Congress was commissioning a study to see whether marshland next to the Potomac would be a fitting place for our national capital, that's the same year, 1781, that L.A. was founded. And it was a place that was, at least the padres of the nearby mission in San Gabriel said, a rowdy, chaotic, criminal place. It got washed away by floods twice and had to be resettled on higher ground. And the third time it caught on.
After those two early washouts, Los Angeles did catch on to the point that it became the second largest city in America, a city that people the world over dream about, a city which in turn manufactures and exports dreams for a living, a city that seems to exist beyond the ho-hum gravitational pull of the rest of America, unless you are its mayor, in which case your concerns are very down to earth. Tell me, maybe in 60 seconds or less, what you actually do in a given day, assuming there is anything like a given day.
Every day is predictably unpredictable. I'll wake up and see emails from the night before of shootings or even homicides in the city. I'll take my daughter to school, try to get some exercise in there before that, and then really do a combination of proactively engaging with people and responding to what's going on in the city. So I'll do everything in the same day, from drive from one end of town to the other, go under a freeway overpass, go into people's tents who are living on the street to talk to them, try to get them off the street, to meeting with a visiting ambassador or head of state, and everything in between.
Garcetti was on the LA City Council for years before becoming mayor in 2013 at just 42 years old, the city's youngest mayor in more than a century. He inherited a projected budget deficit of some $240 million. He'd also get to deal with a water shortage, rising crime rates, and an incessant need for more or better ways to move people around a city that is famous for its traffic. Garcetti studied political science, urban planning, and international affairs at Columbia in New York, then politics at Oxford, and nationalism and ethnicity at the London School of Economics. So it would seem obvious that a political career was always the goal.
Well, I didn't think of electoral politics, to be honest. I thought I'd do human rights work and international development work. I'd spent time in high school in Ethiopia between the famines on a medical relief mission. I had spent time in Burma in the liberated areas where rebels and pro-democracy dissidents fled after the crackdown on Aung San Suu Kyi and her party in the late 80s, early 90s. So I thought it would be maybe something involved in world change, but not necessarily electoral politics. Or it was going to be music. I am a passionate, committed composer, and the guy I used to write musicals with, once he was able to ditch me and get a better composer, actually won the Tony.
That's Brian Yorkey, is that right?
Brian Yorkey, my dear friend, won a Tony and won a Pulitzer. So I was going to just try to ride on his boat for a while, but he got smart.
You are apparently very good at a lot of things, photography and dancing and sharpshooting and acting and composing and playing music. You did very well in academia. You were a Rhodes Scholar, among other things. So first of all, were all these extracurricular activities just part of a grand plan to make yourself an electable politician?
No, but I'm sure my parents' breeding was, because if you have an Italian last name, you're half Mexican and half Jewish, and you can't get elected on that. Who can? But no, I've just always been fascinated by interesting and different things. On my mom's side, the Jewish side of the family, I come from a family of musicians who are pianists, so I've always loved cultural expression. And my dad's a retired politician and lawyer, and now a photographer. So I kind of caught that bug from him. And I've just always loved engaging with ideas and culture. And I think that's part of growing up in LA, where you literally have a community from every culture on the face of the earth, every language, and this kind of geographic crossroads of the world, northern capital of Latin America, western capital of the United States, eastern capital of the Pacific Rim. So it was a natural outgrowth of where I grew up and who raised me.
Eric Garcetti's father, the retired politician and lawyer, is Gil Garcetti, who served two terms as Los Angeles County District Attorney in the 1990s. As Gil Garcetti was first running for the position, there were widespread and brutal riots in L.A. in protest over the Rodney King trial. He was the black man who'd been beaten by four L.A. cops.
The jury in the Rodney King case has delivered its verdict, and not one of the four police officers seen on videotape beating Mr. King a year ago is guilty of using excessive force. They've all been found not guilty.
More than 50 people were killed, a couple thousand injured. What was it like for you as a student in New York with your family from L.A., your father heading toward the D.A., position there? What was it like to watch that happening back home? And I'm curious if or how it affected your future.
It was very otherworldly. You know, I had just left the city the day before and flown back to school, so I missed it by one day. My senior dorm, I remember sitting there, literally seeing my city burn and just feeling powerless and feeling hopeless and wondering whether the great diversity that I loved of our city would be something that would ultimately be the cause of its destruction. Because you remember all the writing then is like, nobody will ever get along and the race relations are so fraught with peril in Los Angeles. What's miraculous to me is, you know, almost 30 years later, 25 years later, you see this is our great strength. I travel to other cities and have my fellow mayors, like the mayor of Seoul, saying, how do we get to be more like LA with the sort of pluralism that you have? Because we need that here if we're going to survive and be competitive. So I think from a very dark moment, we've really figured out a way to get back to the light and to see what has always been a strength of this city, that unmatched kind of cultural diversity that defines LA.
Before the King verdict and the riots, there was, of course, the King beating and the acquittal then of the police officers. How did that affect your view of police work generally and specifically in LA?
Well, a couple things have informed that over time. I have tremendous respect for people who have decided to wear a badge and put their lives on the line for us. I've been with their widows. I've held their children, those who are killed in the line of duty. And I think we have to always recognize that and thank our police officers. I also am the son of a former prosecutor who stood up one of the first divisions, if not the first division in the United States in a district attorney's office to go after public officials, including police officers who were accused of wrongdoing, including police brutality. And at the time, that was a very different Los Angeles Police Department. It was much more inward looking. And he would go and brief, you know, at roll calls, police officers and tell them, look, if you shoot somebody and it's a potentially a criminal act, we're going to roll out and we're going to potentially prosecute you. And police officers would say things like he'd come home and over the dinner table say, a cop told me in one of those roll calls, if you were lying on the streets bleeding and dying, I'd step over you and keep walking. So, you know, I grew up with an understanding that justice wasn't just about the suspects who don't wear badges, but occasionally you have people who exhibit criminal behavior in the police department. Cut ahead, you know, 30 years, and now as mayor of the city, one of the first things I did before Ferguson, before Staten Island, before any of these places, was to become the first big city to begin testing and to roll out the deployment of body cameras. And thinking about that Rodney King moment when we all saw that, that was really one of the first moments videotape caught what we knew happened all too often in too many places, from a very small minority of police officers who tainted the badge for everybody. But now we have police officers who actually have not only said, okay, I'll wear a body camera, but I've talked to ones who say, I love having this. It makes me safer and it makes us more accountable to the public. That builds trust. We're also listening to people and building together with civil rights advocates, the police union, general public. We've had a very open and transparent process saying, give us suggestions of what this policy should look like. And I hope that we can err on the side of as much transparency. But I think that it's most important to send the message that if somebody does break the law, even if they're wearing a badge, that we get a conviction. And I'm really proud that, you know, that many years after Rodney King, that's where Los Angeles is at.
The other case that marked Garcetti's father's career as district attorney was the O.J. Simpson murder trial. Again, as in the Rodney King case, there was an acquittal, but this time it was the defendant who was black and he wasn't a cop. Simpson, former football star, was accused of killing his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ron Goldman. Gil Garcetti's office oversaw the trial and, for the past 21 years, refrained from speaking publicly about it. When asked to participate in the recent ESPN documentary series called OJ, Made in America, Garcetti declined at first, but then he was persuaded.
It was my son who said, "Dad, it's time for you to speak. No one knows the facts that you know."
The verdict was one he disagreed with very strongly, but he also saw it as a moment in time. And I think we've just kind of come to accept that we've turned the page on awareness about domestic violence, that he saw this as the outgrowth, not just it was a random murder from nowhere, but the outgrowth of a domestic violence situation in that household, and that Nicole was a victim that perhaps hadn't spoken up in the face of domestic violence. And he was the first elected DA to as vociferously speak out about that and really make that the cause of his time in office, which I'm very proud of. I mean, even though the verdict didn't come in the way he wanted and that many people believed it should have, I think there's a lot of women who came to him and said, "I finally have the courage to speak up and to speak out." And I think lives were saved. But, you know, I was studying most of the time overseas when that happened. I came back a couple times and it was a media circus unlike anything I had ever seen before. I got to hear some kind of behind the scenes ins and out of what was going on from my dad. But I know that he really believed strongly that this was a moment to raise awareness while also trying to get the guilty verdict that unfortunately didn't come.
How did he explain the verdict that came in that was contrary to his expectation and his belief? Why did he think that verdict happened?
I don't know if he ever had a set reason. I think he's an experienced enough prosecutor to know that juries are groups of human beings and you can never 100% predict what they will do. Obviously, race played some into it, some tactical mistakes that were made along the way. I talked to him recently and, you know, I think one of the lawyers of O.J. Simpson said something like he was taking medicine for his arthritis and was told that if you stop taking it, your joints and your fingers will swell. And that happened before putting on the glove. There's all sorts of, you know, what if and Monday morning quarterbacking. But I think he thought it was a mixture of what was going on with the racial politics and sending a message from this jury, as well as some things that made it a difficult case to prove. But in the end, I think it was something that people felt very strongly about on both sides. And my dad believed he was guilty and still does today.
Let's talk about crime for a moment. Crime in LA is still way, way lower than historic highs, but it has been rising. To what do you attribute the rise and what are you doing about it?
Well, you're right. In the 1860s, the murder rate was 100 times higher than New York. And if we had that same murder rate today, we'd have as many people killed in a week as we do in a year. We have crime levels that are about the equivalent of the mid-1950s. So it's still a very safe city relative to the past. But as I always say, that means nothing if there was gunshots in your neighborhood last night or you were the victim of a crime. And we've seen some low double-digit increases in violent crime for 2 years. I attribute to a couple different things. One is I think in California, we've done a lot of well-intentioned criminal justice reforms, many of which I support, that have taken people out of prison and put them back in our communities, taking the savings to put into job training, rehabilitation, et cetera. But we changed those laws before the programs were in place. So it was a little bit the cart before the horse. We should have had that safety net to catch them. And I am sure that a part of our homelessness rise as well is linked to this. People get out of jail. That first week is so important. They don't have the job skills. If they've just been in a jail that did nothing to rehabilitate them, what do they go back to? The streets, or they go back to crime? And we've seen a spike in particular in property crime around auto-related crime, which means, you know, people breaking into cars to feed probably the addictions they have on the streets when they come out of the criminal justice system. So I think that's one of the big drivers. I think the other one too is that we're seeing a change in how the main driver of crime in LA is still gangs. We've cut gang crime by more than half in the last decade. But gangs are kind of a new generation are coming up, and it's no longer graffiti on a wall that's being crossed out with somebody else's paint. We're seeing it play out on social media in a way that we're having to build up a law enforcement response to be able to monitor that and quickly go after things before they spike. And we're seeing some promise with that. Just this year, we've stood up in South Los Angeles a community safety operations center. It's open about 18 hours a day and has social media people who are following social media. It's looking at who are the few people who carry the guns and are the shooters and trying to get them, as New York City has been doing in the last year quite effectively. And we're seeing the crime rise in those areas begin to level off and even come down in the last few months.
I saw that you recently held a gun buyback, which we wrote a little bit about that in Freakonomics years ago. The evidence from gun buybacks suggests that they're great for show, but that's it, that no one who would ever use a gun in a crime is actually going to turn it into a buyback. In fact, in the Instagram picture that you posted, Mr. Mayor, I see a bunch of kind of old wooden-barreled rifles that people turned in, which are, you know, not the street crime guns. So I'm curious, what's the scope of your gun plan, and please tell me it's not entirely based on buybacks.
No, it definitely is not. And I think that buybacks, there's a lot of academic work on it, and some of it quite dated now. But it's not just about ones that will be used in crimes. There's one woman who brought a bunch of guns in from her father, who had dementia and was threatening to use the guns against other people and himself. And, you know, whether it's suicides or accidents, I am convinced for sure that there's some gun we have taken off the streets that would have been used in some death of some sort, and even if it's one, that's worth it. So it's not just the show, it's also the education around that. We've done other things. Now we've passed some pretty first-in-the-nation laws that there's a mandate to keep your guns locked when you have them at home. We have banned the possession of large magazines, large-capacity magazines for ammunition. We've looked at public housing and gone after people to be able to kick them out of housing if they have illegal guns. And we've been trying to stand up kind of going after those illegal guns that are on our streets, working very closely with the ATF to make sure that we can trace back guns and go to the bad apple gun dealers. There's really a few gun dealers around the country that you can trace a lot of the guns back to that are used in crimes. And we also have something else quite effective from kind of at least the economics or human behavior perspective, written letters to people who buy guns inside the city saying that if you're buying this gun for somebody else, that's illegal. And since we have a waiting period here, when we've used those letters, we've seen as high as 40% of the people not come back to pick up the guns that they already paid for. So straw buyers, which are the ways that criminals and other people are getting a lot of their guns, we've been able to keep those out of their hands.
Garcetti has been called a pothole politician for his embrace of all kinds of unsexy projects like repaving streets, decreasing garbage, conserving water and energy, lowering response time for emergency services, all of which had to be accomplished, remember, with a large budget deficit. So let's go back to the beginning of your time as mayor. What did you decide to do about that deficit, and what goals did you set generally for your administration?
Well, I set a very straightforward goal of getting back to the basics, which is, I think, what municipal government's about. People will give you the responsibility, even the authority to go after the big things, the visionary things, the, you know, reaching for incredible opportunities, if they trust that you're running a city well. And if you don't run a city well, conversely, you can't do the big things. So first and foremost, it was balancing that budget, which we've done 3 years in a row. Our bond rating has gone up. It's putting a reserve fund of a record high, squirrel that away to make sure the next time recession comes that we're in a better place. And then just investing in the infrastructure. We stopped trimming trees. We weren't fixing sidewalks. We weren't paving streets to the level. And we have records of all of those now in just 2.5 years. At the same time, we're doing huge infrastructure things. And I think my three goals were to rebuild our economy and prepare us for the next 25 years of prosperity, build our infrastructure out in a country where it's crumbling, and be ready for the next 50 years of our physical needs here. And then third was to build trust back into city government. And so with the economy, we've seen unemployment cut in half. I've focused on key industries like technology. LA now has more tech jobs than any county in America. We're the trade capital of America, record tourism. I'm looking at all sorts of green jobs as well, where we've become kind of the world capital of that. On infrastructure, we're building more than any other city in the U.S. as well, from $15 billion at our airport to 5 rail lines under construction. So the infrastructure piece is really important as we see the nation unable to do that from Washington. We're doing that ourselves. And then the last piece of just trusting government, I want people to be excited about government. And that starts by getting a call returned and not being on hold for 40 minutes, getting the stop sign up that you need, the speed bumps that slow the traffic down on your street where your kids play. Then, you know, people will give you the permission to do things as we've done, like raise the minimum wage, go after, you know, affordable housing and try to crack the back of homelessness here in our city where we're the homeless capital of America. So, you know, those three themes have allowed us to really now tackle what I think are the two biggest problems we face, homelessness and traffic, both of which we're unfortunately well known for.
In terms of traffic, if there's one American city that would seem immune to a European-style makeover of its transportation, emphasizing rail and foot traffic rather than car traffic, it would seem, at least to me, to be L.A. and because of its size and its historic reliance on the automobile. But I gather you definitely don't share that view. I know you're pushing for lots of walkable areas and lots of train travel. Can you talk about, you know, obviously L.A. will never be a small, compact European city, but what is your ultimate vision for that?
Well, I don't want to bring a European city or an East Coast city to the West Coast. We're proud of kind of the amazing weather, topography, and the geography that we have. And it's a little bit of Back to the Future, because even across these long distances, we had the best public transportation system, arguably, of a city of our size in the country until in the 1950s. You know, the way autonomous vehicles are the next big thing, these things called cars and freeways were the next big thing. And so we got rid of an incredible red car system, which was a streetcar system that traveled the distances we're now rebuilding. You know, LA is a very much of a postmodern city. A traditional city has one center, it's bounded, and it's vertical. We will always be, relative to other cities, much more horizontal. We're unbounded, and we have many centers. And to me, that's exciting. It's more kind of the way London grew up, a collection of villages. And I think you need to build up transit options that get people from one village to the next and make the village a little bit more self-contained.
As I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the mayor of L.A. is somewhat constrained by the fact that you share administrative responsibilities with L.A. County, and you don't have that much control over, say, education, which is largely overseen by the state. Can you talk just for a minute about the power of your office, or leverage, whatever you want to use, relative to, say, the mayor of another big city like New York City or Chicago?
Well, it is a strong mayor system here. It's very analogous to federal government. You know, I write the budget. Like Congress, our city council can change that. I have veto power. They can override that. I appoint all of the 37 general managers and chiefs who oversee things that some other cities don't have. For instance, it's the largest municipal utility, our Department of Water and Power, in the country. New York doesn't own that. Chicago doesn't own that. We have our own airport that's not done by a port authority. And the Port of LA, which is the biggest port in America, together with Long Beach, responsible for 43% of the goods that come in, are under my control. But it's true that a lot of the health and human services and the education pieces are in separate governments. And LA is, you know, people have always said LA is a liberal place. I always point out that it was kind of built as a libertarian place. How else could you explain that in a county of Los Angeles, which is 10 million people, in a metro area of 17 million, just in that county alone, we have 88 cities. So I'm just one mayor of 88. Now, it's the biggest city by far, but one of the ways I've exercised power to transcend that is every quarter I bring together the other 87 mayors with me, and we talk about things that ignore our borders. Crime or traffic or air quality doesn't stop between Beverly Hills and Los Angeles or between Santa Monica and Los Angeles. You have to solve those things together. But the other way that I think you can influence, you know, the county of Los Angeles has all the hospitals, has all the general relief money, has the child welfare policy. So if you go after something like homelessness, really the mental health needs and the human services needs are something from the county. And people for too long have had a rivalry out here. The city hated the county hated the city, mayors don't get along with supervisors, vice versa. And I've just spent a lot of time building those relationships to a place where I think that even though those formal boundaries are up, we can make a huge influence on education. For instance, we just announced that we'll be the biggest city in America to enact America's promise to make community college free. And this graduating class of this next year of our Los Angeles Unified School District will get community college free if they graduate. And that's something that I launched together with them. So you're right, I'm somewhat constrained, but only as constrained as your imagination and your relationships take you.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, what kind of incentives does Mayor Garcetti believe in?
You're now getting to the core of my political philosophy, which is money and guilt.
We also ask Garcetti to confirm or deny some rumors we've heard.
They're all lies.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We're talking today with Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. L.A. may have a lot of natural attributes, but water is not one of them. L.A. has to buy a lot of its water, and with a long and severe drought in California, that water's gotten more expensive. So what have you been doing about that?
A lot of stuff. I mean, water built this city. Anybody who's seen Chinatown knows the history. One of the first things I did was actually, after a 100-year war, make peace with the folks whose water we were stealing in Chinatown up in Inyo County, to be able to have them retain more of the water and have us retain more of the water, because we were wasting a lot of it to try to keep dust from blowing on an old lake bed in up in Inyo County. Second, when we heard about the drought, I pointed out that Angelenos have been amazing. We consume the same amount of water today as we did 30 years ago with a million more people. So we went from 3 to 4 million people, and collectively we consume actually a little bit less water than we did then. And so I said, we've done this in the past. We're able to do this. We waste so much water. How many lawns do we have? Which is 50% of our water use is our landscaping. And how many people are on those lawns? I said, if you have a lawn and you're using it, great, keep it and pay for the water to water it. But if you're not, well, let us pay you to switch that out to beautiful flowering green plants that use a lot less water. And we were able to do that with over 50 million square feet of lawn just in the last couple of years. We reduced our water in the face of this drought, our water usage, by 19% without having to fine anybody, without having to, you know, crack down with the water police, but by inspiring people through public education and rebates, giving them free cisterns, changing out their toilets, all those sorts of things. And the quality of life is still great. So I look at this as a great opportunity for us to reduce our water bills, our water dependency. And then long term, I put forward a plan for us to move from only 15% of our water actually comes from underneath our city, and to make that number 50% by 2035. We can do that through a combination of recycling, reusing, and retaining the water that already falls into the basin here in Los Angeles. It's kind of this perverse thing that we engineered all the water that falls outside of our city to come through a series of expensive and complex aqueducts to our city for our use. But anything that actually falls when it rains here in the city gets quickly washed out to the ocean. And that's, last I checked, the only place that doesn't need any more.
So I'm curious, of all the different incentives that you've used to encourage water conservation, what worked best? Because a lot of the work that we do with Freakonomics is looking at the incentives that we think will work well, that people will respond to, but we're often surprised by what actually works. And I'm curious if you could generalize for anybody out there who's trying to come up with an incentive plan, maybe it has nothing to do with water, but whether financial is stronger than moral, is stronger than social, and so on.
Well, you're now getting to the core of my political philosophy, which is money and guilt. These two things work. Give people money to change their behavior, and that helps them bridge the kind of scary new frontier of doing something like, oh my gosh, a house without a lawn, and guilt. Steve Carell, the actor, and I did these great spots, because it's Hollywood out here, on the radio. We invented a character called The Drop, who shows up on red carpets and shows up at events in the community. And we said, save the drop. And, you know, maybe it's that I'm half Catholic, half Jewish, but guilt seems to work really well, and money seems to get the job done.
Economists like to point out that we in this country and in most countries have never done a very good job of pricing water. A city like LA is probably paying way too much if there were a kind of fair, equitable market for water, while a lot of agricultural areas are heavily subsidized and therefore underpaying. Do you agree with that assessment, or do you just kind of accept your lot and move on?
Well, I don't like kind of pitting people like farmers against urban dwellers together, because both are very important. We have to eat things, and we need to have that as a part of our economy, and we need cities to be able to exist well. The technology actually could solve this, so it's a non-issue. We need much more drip irrigation in our Central Valley. Look at what Israel's done. Look what Australia's done. They're water pioneers when it comes to agriculture. And similarly, in our urban areas, the sewage water we have gets completely treated to an almost drinkable standard. It's a little bit more saline, but it's not contaminated in any way, and gets washed out to the ocean every day, about the equivalent of 60% of our daily water use. Well, places like Orange County, a county to our south, have been purifying that water for a long time. But years ago here, when somebody called it toilet to tap, suddenly people said, yuck, we can never do that. Even though nature does it every single day. What was once in your toilet will one day be falling from a cloud from the sky. So we're rebranding it from toilet to tap, from showers to flowers, and letting people know this is a natural part of what we're doing. And we're looking at how do you recycle much more water? And then you don't have to pit farmers against, you know, city folk. We actually have plenty of water. It's a resource which is renewable, which we have in the state. And I'm not worried that even in a drought, if this is the new normal, that we can't sustain both.
It strikes me that you are embracing digital technology to be used in almost any quadrant of your job to upgrade anything from commuting to sanitation and so on. Can you talk about generally why you're so enthusiastic about that and then give some specific examples?
Do we have another 45 minutes?
I do. I think you're the one with the busy schedule, yeah.
Well, I'm certainly a tech enthusiast, but even though that is exciting to me, I want to be clear, as a mayor, I don't believe in tech for tech's sake. It has to be a means to an end. But I'll give you a couple examples. When I came in, the city of Los Angeles was unranked in terms of our openness to sharing our data. We have, for instance, the most robust collection of traffic sensors in the world, which was the legacy of the 1984 Olympics. But we weren't storing the data year to year. We were actually destroying it and we weren't using it. We didn't have data. Look at something like police shootings that was robust enough on the ethnicity of folks who were, you know, involved in those shootings, on the mental health aspects of that, et cetera. And so, you know, across my 37 departments, I said, we are going to now have an open data directive. And in just 2 years, we've become ranked number one in the country, the number one city for open data. And I love it. We're now the city that has the largest hackathons, municipal hackathons anywhere in America. We're seeing, you know, students become great workers for the tech jobs that are out here, but also solving things like doing drought hacks and doing homelessness hacks and things that will actually use digital technology to solve the most pressing problems we have. You know, people said, oh, people are going to use this data against you. And I said, that's the point. You know, when the LA Times did its article that pointed out, for instance, what the response times were for our fire department, that helped us get them better. They were able to uncover, for instance, that trash, when people called in a couch that they wanted the city to collect in South Los Angeles, was moving sometimes three times slower than one from a different part of the city. And it allowed us to say, we're going to own that. We're going to fix it. And to implement a whole new way of using technology, we are the first city in the country to drive every block of every street, take pictures, and to give them a grade on how clean they are. So we now have, you know, essentially A, B, C, and we're not going to have any more C streets in 2 years because we use data in the right way. So whatever can improve the quality of life, to make government more accountable, to make, you know, your commute and your life in the city a little bit healthier and better, that's where I kind of point technology to.
You successfully pushed to raise the minimum wage in LA to $15 by the year 2020, a move that was followed by California statewide. A lot of economists, as I'm sure you know, argue that raising the minimum wage may have the perverse effect of making entry-level jobs scarcer, destroying those jobs, or driving employers to use more automation rather than human employees. Are you worried about that?
Well, some economists do, more economists don't. And we, I think all economists would if we did it too high. It's all about where you put the level of raising the wage. And for us, we worked very hard to look at real world examples. There's always the sky is falling if you raise the minimum wage. And we looked at cities in California, some which were wealthy and some which were relatively poor, and looked at job growth in their neighboring cities where they hadn't raised the minimum wage. And we saw more growth in the places that had actually raised the minimum wage. We work with Berkeley economists and others to make sure that we are trying to peg it at the right level. And I think that while there is some job displacement, there will be net job growth, and no question that there'll be net economic activity. When you give people at the lowest end of the economic spectrum money in their pocket, that's not something that gets saved, it gets spent. And the kind of perverse decisions people have to choose between shoes for their kids at the beginning of the school year and paying off their phone bill, you can see some of those things begin to recede. And I think that there's no question there are some people in certain industries that are affected, but we see overall much more new job growth because of the main streets that right now are suffering because people don't have any disposable income in some of our working class neighborhoods rise up.
Another position that many, if not most, economists will argue is that hosting a big event like the Olympics is a terrible idea, economically at least, that the costs are always way higher than projected and the benefits are much smaller. And yet you are trying to bring the Summer Olympics back to L.A. in 2024. Why do you want the Olympics, and what would L.A. do that many other places have not been able to do?
Well, first of all, I agree with those analyses. Andrew Zimbalist and others who have looked at it, he's somebody who I've become friendly with, and so far has been actually quite supportive of the way that we're going about the Los Angeles bid. You know, for a 2.5 week extravaganza to build temporary stadiums and then take them down, for instance, doesn't make a lot of sense for your city or for the Olympics. And I think the Olympics understand that. They want to have a more sustainable model. And the reason why Los Angeles, in our last poll, 88% of people support the Olympics here, is they know that we've been able to do this without public money in the past. In fact, we made a profit in 1984 and helped save the Olympics. And that we have such an amazing sports infrastructure that any city that decides, because they're going to get something like a World Fair or the Olympics or the World Cup, that's going to build a whole bunch of infrastructure, that seems to be backwards. Shouldn't we be building infrastructure for the people who are here all the time, not just for a few weeks for the sporting event? And LA, fortunately, is doing that. We're fixing our airport, whether the Olympics come or not. We're building the public transportation at a level no other city is in America, whether they come or not. But what we offer then to the Olympics is, this is a great way to show that if we have all these sports facilities already built, I think we have all but one built, without that being on the Olympic ledger, this is an ideal place to be able to hold those Olympics and to make sure people focus on what's important, the sports and bringing people together, and a legacy that isn't just about redeveloping one neighborhood and maybe gentrifying it. We've got the, you know, everything from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to tell the stories of the athletes, and I think that should be attractive to the Olympics and should be sustainable to us financially.
It was time now for a few of our frequently asked questions. If you had a time machine, when would you travel to? Forward or backward? And what would you want to do there?
Oh God, I'm such a student of history. There's so many places I'd like to go backwards and see, but I'm definitely going to hit the forward button just because. I want to see what happens to this earth. I want to see whether we're able, you know, we will definitely see seas rise. I want to know what the impact of that's going to be. I want to see a vision of that so I could come back and say, it's real, it's going to happen. There won't be a North Pole. California is going to be a desert. I think it's probably the most pressing thing, and I just want to get that question answered.
Tell me the last, let's say, 3 books you've read and what you took away from each of them.
I'm in the middle of almost about to finish Whatever Happened to the Metric System, which is written by my dear friend John Marciano. Great book. When I was a kid, we were all going to give up, you know, our American standard system and go to metric system. And it just shows about the idealism of clocks, of measures, the French Revolution, the metric system, the people like John Quincy Adams, and historical figures that have been idealists and practical ones. Another book that I have been reading is called Walkable City. It's a great, great book that kind of looks at how we can turn places even like Los Angeles and not just think about the view from the car, but how we can look at the view from the sidewalks and make sure that we have something that is more human-centered. And I've been rereading Jorge Luis Borges' Laberintos, or Labyrinths. He's my favorite author. And the moment that we ever think we have the world organized, I just read about one of my favorite short stories in it is The Library of Babel, which says that the universe essentially is a set of interconnected hexagonal rooms of books, and every book that could ever be written in every combination of words in every language is in this infinite library. And I love that as an idea.
I've been told a few things about you, and I want to know if they're true.
They're all lies.
Is it true that you once accepted a bet that you could swallow a giant ball of wasabi?
Yes, and I ate that. I got that sushi for free that night.
Okay. Is it true, Mr. Mayor, that you are able to fall asleep anywhere for any amount of time, no matter how short?
Yes, I'm very proud of my sleep capacity. It's been enacted on a New York subway, on a trotting horse, on a speedboat jumping ocean waves. And almost every day, that's when I catch up, especially as the father of a young daughter. It's that 10 minutes between events where I fall asleep in a car. And you give me 20 minutes or you give me 20 hours, I will fall asleep.
Is it true that while running the Paris Marathon in 1994, you wore a turtleneck to conceal the hickeys you'd received from the woman who would become your wife?
You've got good sources. I might have worn it before, but I did not run the marathon in a turtleneck. That would have been unfitting. But yes, I ran the Paris Marathon, which was incidentally sponsored by McDonald's. And after 26.2 miles of running past McDonald's signs, it's all I wanted was a Big Mac.
But you left out the hickey part. Were there hickeys from your future wife involved?
Yeah, I believe there was at least one. I don't know if it's plural, but there might have been one.
And our final frequently asked question, what would you consider, for the sake of humankind, the best possible future discovery or invention?
The best possible future discovery or invention isn't maybe new, but I think it would be something emotional, not physical, but a sense of love and solidarity and common purpose.
Nice answer. I've just about used up our allotted time. I very much enjoyed it and appreciate the conversation, Mr. Mayer. I do have one last request. I don't know if you can accommodate this.
I'll try my best.
I understand you have a piano in your office.
I do.
If you're in your office, can you get yourself to the piano and can you play us some outro music?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I've been working on a song called Central Avenue, after Central Avenue, which was like the 42nd Street of the West Coast. So a little jazz for you on the way out.
Thanks to Eric Garcetti, mayor of the city of Los Angeles. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. You can also find us at Freakonomics.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and if you want to drop us an email, we're at radio@Freakonomics.com. Thanks again.